Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. My website is ScottHorton.org. We're streaming from ScottHorton.org live from 11 to 1 Texas time, 12 to 2 Eastern every weekday. And also from No Agenda Global Radio at NoAgendaStream.com, AnomalyRadio.com, Liberty Movement Radio, and LibertyExpressRadio.com, and a bunch of other places. How do you like that? Full interview archives, more than 2,800 of them, are all available at ScottHorton.org. All right, first up today is our good friend Ray McGovern. He is a veteran intelligence professional for sanity. He writes at raymcgovern.com and at consortiumnews.com, and he's giving a speech to a peace group near you. Welcome back to the show, Ray. How are you doing?
Good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great. I really appreciate you joining us today. And lots of important stuff to talk about. First of all, what's going on down there at Guantanamo Bay, man? Just hit us hard with this thing.
Well, since early February, upwards of 100, latest figure I think is 121 men have decided to escape, okay? Now, the only way open for them to escape from this hopeless situation is to by starving themselves to death. They have the right to do that under international law, under all manner of law, but we are preventing them from doing that because we don't want them to die, and the president said that. You know, we're going to force feed them because we don't want them to die. Well, why not? I mean... You've held them for 10, 11 years without charge, without judicial process. Why not let them die, for God's sake? Well, it will be blot on the nation's conscience. Well, if Guantanamo isn't already a blot on the nation's conscience, I don't know what is. So what we have here is coming up, I think it's Friday, on the 100th day of this hunger strike. There are, as I think I said, a little bit over 20 that are acknowledged by the Army to be being force-fed, and that's a very painful process, as you know. The AMA, the American Medical Association, has come out and said that that's cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment, which, of course, we're a signatory to a treaty banning that. It's called the War Crimes Treaty. So what we have is a situation where these people are not being allowed to die. I don't know how long they can keep them. I suppose they keep them alive indefinitely. And the president's and the Army's solution to this, of course, is to send down 40 more medical technicians with 40 more plastic tubes to stick in these gentlemen's noses down through their esophagus into their stomach to keep them alive so that Guantanamo will not be a blot on the nation's conscience if we let them die. My goodness, America has come to this.
That's incredible. Well, now listen, so first of all, the suicide is actually option two, right? I mean, what they're doing with this hunger strike is they're begging and pleading and crying for the American people to do something about this.
Well, yeah, I guess I'm projecting here. I can't imagine that after 11 years in a place like that, they could still harbor much hope that we Americans will do the right thing. And you know, it's easy enough to accuse Bush and Rumsfeld, war criminals though they be, and Obama, wuss that he is. You know, he pretends that Congress has tied his hands, and yet none other than Carl Levin, chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, has reminded the president that in the legislation that makes it difficult to let people go, there's a national security waiver open to the president and the secretary of defense to exercise. And Levin and some of the more forward-looking people thought long and hard about this and fought a long time to get that waiver in.
Right.
And so Levin's saying to the president, Mr. President, why not release the 86 of the 166 still there? 86 have been cleared for release. You could do that with a stroke of the pen. Do not make believe that the burden is on us in Congress. We fought for that exemption. Why don't you use it? So what I'm trying to say, Scott, here is that we're not all guilty. You and I are not guilty, but we are responsible. Otherwise, we shouldn't pretend that we're in a democracy. Now, I'm quoting Abraham Heschel, my favorite rabbi prophet, okay? And what he said was, we're not all guilty, but we are responsible. And being responsible means trying to do something about this. And finally, we got a congressman, happens to be my congressman here in the 8th District of Virginia, Jim Moran, who has the courage, the moral courage, to stand up and say, this is so wrong, I'm going to hold a hearing. Now, 11 years later, a hearing? Why not? He's going to hold a briefing. I'm sorry, misspoke here. He can't hold a hearing because hearings can only be held with the consent and usually at the initiative of a chair of one of the committees in Congress. And no Republican, they have all the chairs, of course, in the House, no Republican will do it. So Jim Moran decided he would have a briefing. We all got together, and with the urgency of the situation, with people on the edge of death, we did this in 9 days, set up an incredible panel with Larry Wilkerson, George Hunsinger from Princeton Theological Seminary, a woman from the Human Rights Watch, and a general who was on the panel, or actually he was a member of the committee that put out that report on torture, the Constitution Project, and they spoke eloquently. And we were led, or the moderator was Christine Husky, who represented people in Guantanamo on two very important cases. So there we were. There was C-SPAN, to its credit, and you can get it on C-SPAN. But no press, no other members of Congress, lots of staffers there for kind of curiosity. But so it's reached the pass where I think Americans, to the degree they feel strongly about this, and by God, they ought to feel strongly. You know, when I think about other Virginians here, Patrick Henry, you know, he faced into this, and he said, you know, the rack and the screw should be left back in old Europe and left there for good. We're better than that, said Patrick Henry. Now, have we forgotten that? My God. So, anyhow, we had this hearing. It did not get much resonance, but people can tune into it. Look at C-SPAN for the hearing on Guantanamo, orchestrated by James Moran and many of his constituents.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, one of the things here is that Obama's no wuss, Ray. Obama is an evil villain. He's nothing but Dick Cheney, only taller and skinnier, and you know it, and we all know it. And Carl Levin, that same Carl Levin, told the Washington Post years ago that, geez, we all got to work on ending Guantanamo and getting the legislation going and getting the hearings going and getting all the things together, and then we realized that the president wasn't doing a single thing to help us whatsoever, and we needed his leadership to get it through the Senate, and we sure as hell could have, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and then we realized he never meant it. He was never going to follow through. He was never going to help us, and so all we were doing was sticking our necks out for the Republicans to cut him off with no backup from him whatsoever because he never meant to close Guantanamo Bay. This guy could start a war with Russia right now if he wanted to, but he doesn't have the power to close Guantanamo Bay? Come on.
Well, you have a good point there, Scott. It's highly ironic that President Obama would get up and say, you know, this is really beyond the pale. We can't be holding prisoners indefinitely. And he said that, indefinitely. That's not, you know, we're better than that. We have to do something about this as though he can't do anything himself. So, you know, that we have that on the one hand. Oh, Congress won't let me do it. And then, on the other hand, we've got the same president that launches a war on Libya without even, by the way, this is what we're going to do to Congress. He didn't even tell him, okay? A president who asserts the prerogative to kill American citizens if they happen to be on the list that John Brennan or his successor present to him. So
yeah, and to arm al-Qaeda in Syria, too.
Yeah. So, right. So, the guy is duplicitous. He's a wuss. You know, I don't call people evil because I think there's always a slice of honesty and good in people. I take him at his word that he's no leader.
But he's a deliberate actor. See, that's the thing. Wuss implies that he's just, a reed in the wind. He's the second most powerful man in the history of all of humanity. He's not a reed in the wind.
Who was the first?
George W. Bush, of course. He took America to the peak of empire and started down the other side.
Yeah.
But Obama still is more powerful than Bill Clinton before Jr., by far.
Well, yeah, I agree. What I'm saying here is that we're into semantics here. The effect of being a wuss or being a deliberate plotter of all this is the same, disgrace to our country.
Sure.
And as I started to say before, I think we need to take Obama at his word. It's not my concept of leadership, but he actually said explicitly, no politician is going to take any action unless he has the full support of the people.
Right. And you know what? The thing is, what's funny too, is I've made that exact same argument about what a wimpy is over and over again. He's backed down on everything he ever said he was going to do, good or bad, pretty much. The only promises he ever keeps are bad ones, but he backs down on those too. I mean, he backs down on virtually everything he's ever said. Uh-oh, now we're going to have to talk about Israel and Palestine.
Well, just a final word on this. I think Rabbi Heschel is right. I think there are enough Americans with conscience that they can rise up and say this is an abomination that we would let these people die or force them to live under these circumstances. It is an abomination, and I think there are enough of us. Maybe we wouldn't succeed this year, but who knows? We need to stick our necks out. We can't be deterred by the thought we might not be successful. It's not about being successful. It's about being faithful to the ideal of America. And, this Friday we're celebrating the anniversary of the brave Berrigan brothers. What do they call that little town there in Maryland? Catonsville 9, okay? And, they weren't successful. They were laughed at just as we will be. But over the longer term, and it wasn't all that long, a year or two, the nation was up in arms against another injustice, the war on Vietnam, and I think that one deserves the label evil.
Yeah, well, for sure. All right, now, and you know what? Now, let's stay on Guantanamo real quick before we talk about Israel and all that. The un-American-ness of it all. It seems to me like there have been a lot of lines crossed lately, and that maybe there's so many lines crossed now that really that's what America does mean now, is all this injustice and cruelty and hypocrisy and all of that. Just like, hey, a lot of people would argue that all along, right? That, I guess when I look at it, I sort of like to believe that there's enough people trying to live up to the good part of the American ideal all along that it's still true, even though there's a lot of bad that has gone with it and all that kind of thing. But now it seems like it's just the abandoning of whatever it was supposed to be. It ain't now. The USA's the homeland now, Ray. We're living in the future after it's already too late.
Well, that is a prevailing sentiment. And Chris Hedges, who was on Amy Goodman this morning, is one of the most eloquent articulators of that vision. But even Chris says, look, I have a lawsuit against the National Defense Authorization Act. There is a critical mass that is coming into being here that never looks like much. And, I was through Vietnam. I was through some more things than the younger folks. And so what I would say is we're not going to go do violent revolution, of course, but we are going to do nonviolent civil disobedience. And that means that people like you and I, okay, people like you and I who have this knapsack of white privilege that we never even think about need to take it off and put it on the table, bring this stuff out of there, our education, all the other benefits that we have that others don't, and put them into play. What do I mean? I mean risk. risk harm, risk injury, risk suffering for a cause. Now, suffering, of course, suffering with, that's the etymological derivation of compassion. So I think Americans do have compassion. It's going to take a little longer than anyone would like. But what we need to do is stop sitting back and saying, oh, this is terrible, but invoke the NOAA principle. And let me tell your listeners what the NOAA principle is. No more predicting rain. Awards only for building arcs.
Yeah.
What we got to do is build some arcs.
Yeah, you know, my problem is I'm just way too pessimistic, especially for being a radio show host, right? I'm supposed to have some kind of promise for people. But, you know, the very first time I ever interviewed Ron Paul, I asked him, well, what's the point? You know, that's the best congressman in history from my point of view, as you know. And so I says, well, if there's only one of you ever that's, you know, this good on that many things and this faithful to those principles, then what's the point even? And his thing was, well, you know, we used to think the Soviet Union would last, and then, look, it's gone. And so your job is not to predict doom. Your job is to just keep teaching people about liberty and peace, and we'll see what happens kind of thing. And that's really the right attitude to have.
That's right on. Mm-hmm.
I know that in my head even when I don't feel that way sometimes.
No.
I need to start smoking again. That's my problem. All right, listen. So you gave this speech, and you'll have to explain who the audience was, but you began with the story of the USS Liberty, and I like to believe that people in the audience know what that is. I guess you'll have to remind everybody just to make sure. But then also what's extremely newsworthy about this was the reaction of the audience to me, and then we can go into all different Israel-Palestine issues from there if you'd like, please, sir.
Sure. What happened was this. I was asked to address the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations up there in Maine. And this is a pretty prestigious group up there, mostly retired Foreign Service officers or ambassadors or prominent business people or intelligence people, military generals and that kind of thing, okay? So they know a little bit about foreign policy. I looked at their website and found out that Stephen Walt, of Mearsheimer and Walt, the two authors of the Israel Lobby, had spoken to them in July of last year and sort of prepared my way. You know, it was really, really easy just to pick up where Stephen Walt left off. And I thought that I would try to grab their attention by showing something that Walt and Mearsheimer didn't mention in their article on the Israel Lobby. And so I referred back to a tour of Missouri universities, colleges, and some churches there that I did 6 years ago. I arrived in Springfield, Missouri, and addressed a congregation of about 300 people. And it was just after Mearsheim and Walt's article on the Israel Lobby, and so I was asked in the Q&A, Mr. McGovern, what do you think of Mearsheim and Walt's expose of the poignant influence that Israel exerts on our body politic? And I said what I thought. I had just read it on the plane. I said, you know, I think it's an excellent thing, but they missed the most conclusive proof that Israel can get away with murder, and our White House, our Congress, you know, nobody will say anything. They'll all cover it up, including our media. And then I looked at these blank stares, you know, and I said, I'm referring, of course, to the USS Liberty incident. Still blank stares. So I said, well, how many people have heard about the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty? Three hands go up, Scott. Average, actually, one out of 100, you know. So I picked the guy in the front. I said, gentlemen, sir, would you tell us how you learned about it? And I couldn't believe it. Up stands this ramrod Marine, and he says, sir, Sergeant Bryce Lockwood, U.S. Marine Corps, member of the USS Liberty's crew, sir.
And I That's said, one no. of the three who even knew about it at all. He was
right.
there.
Yeah. So I said, now, would you come up and tell the people what happened? This is what I got. Sir, I've not been able to do that yet, but It's been 40 years. I'd like to try to do that tonight. He came up and he gave the an incredible 5 minutes of the Israeli deliberate attack on the USS Liberty on the 8th of June, 1967, during the Six-Day War, how they reconnoitered it in the morning, came back with fighter bombers and torpedo ships and did all they could to sink it and leave no survivors, how one brave sailor got a message out, an SOS, to the Sixth Fleet, at which point Admiral Geis sent fighter bombers from the USS Saratoga, the USS America, to do battle with whoever it was that was attacking his ship. And they were called back by President Johnson saying, I don't want to get my friends in Israel in any trouble. You call those fighter bombers back. Now, luckily, ironically, Israel had intercepted the SOS, and so they got out of Dodge. They were not able, even though they strafed the lifeboats, by the way, a war crime, pure and simple, they were not able to sink the ship and leave no survivors. It limped back to Malta. 34 U.S. crewmen, Navy people, were killed, and Marines, 170-plus, very badly wounded. They were taken to Athens to get medical attention and visited the next day by very senior naval officers, saying to each of them, each of the survivors, you are not to say a word about how Israel attacked your ship yesterday, not to your wives, not to other members of the crew, not to anyone. And if you do, you'll be court-martialed. Wow. Now, you want to see PTSD? I know these guys, okay? I had dinner and lunch with them, okay? And when they explained to me, Mr. McGovern, you know, when we couldn't even discuss this with our own mates, with our own fellow crew people, I mean, this was really, really hard. Now we can, just because good people have come forward and said this whole thing was covered up. Admiral Maurer, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at one point, has done an independent investigation saying that Israel deliberately did. There's no doubt. We have intercepts, you know. But, sir, there's an American flag there. Do your duty. Strafe it. Bomb it. Sink it. Okay? It's right there. Israeli communication. So there's no doubt that they did it deliberately. The question is, you know, what was the rationale? There are three theories for that, but I won't go into that because of time limitations. The point here is that in this august audience of, you know, rather senior foreign policy specialist, it was the same ratio. There was just a handful of people who put their hands up when I said, who here knows about the USS Liberty and the attack on it on June 8th, 1967? A handful of hands went up. And that's the story. The press, the government, even the Navy, to its discredit, suppressed all this. And when Captain McGonagall, the skipper, who was badly wounded but limped, he made the ship limp back to Malta. He finally, the Navy got some courage, and they said, "Could we pretty please maybe give him the Medal of Honor?" And the White House deliberated, said, "Well, all right." And then, you know what the State Department did, Scott? They went to the Israeli embassy and they said, "Would you have any objection if we gave Captain McGonagall, the skipper of the USS, a Medal of Honor?" And they said, "No, you go ahead." And guess what? The Medal of Honor was given to Captain McGonagall, not in the White House, not in the Oval Office, as is usually the case. It was given alongside the stinking Anacostia River, where there's a very small naval base, given in the early evening of a Friday, and nobody came. That's how bad it is. And so my point simply is that if people don't know about the USS Liberty, then they have no idea that the Israelis can get away with murder, literally, in this case, 34 U.S. sailors, and injuries to 170-plus others. So this speaks volumes, and why Walt and Mearsheimer left that out of their compendium, which was really designed to show the power of the Israel lobby, is just something I can't figure out. But
you think that's a testament to the power of the Israel lobby itself, that, oh, man, we don't want to get into that one?
Well, you know, I know Walt pretty well, and, you know, it's a conundrum. I don't know I mean, they were pretty blunt about the rest of it. I can't imagine they didn't know about the USS Liberty, but why they left it out, I just don't know.
Well, I think, you know, I'm just guessing and speculation or whatever, but I figure, you know, maybe it's because at least the official story still has it, an accident, right? It's not like even after all these years that it's pretty much beyond dispute the way you categorize it. I mean, they still argue anyway. They haven't conceded the point.
Yeah, they just don't touch it. It's sort of like the plague. You know, you don't go near it. And that's what we need to do. We need to show that this is the effect of this slavish devotion to a country whose interests are not the same as ours. It wouldn't be so bad, Scott, if our first president, General Washington, didn't explicitly warn about passionate attachments of one country to another where the other country's interests are assumed to be identical to your own country. He talked about entangling alliances. And that's another thing. You know, people keep referring to Israel as our ally. Israel is not our ally. What is necessary to be an ally? A mutual defense treaty. There is none. There is none. And so, in a
how about even the slightest bit of faithfulness on their part at all?
Well, you know. Well, the point is, most people don't realize we offered them a treaty. You know, after the Arabs did attack them in 1973, we said, "Hey, let's do a mutual defense treaty." And that way, you know, Arabs are going to think twice before attacking you again. And the Israelis said, "Oh, isn't that sweet?" Well, thanks, but no thanks. Now, why? Mutual defense treaties require international recognized boundaries, and for obvious reasons, Israel won't want to get into that.
Right.
And the other thing is a sort of a moral obligation, sometimes explicitly stated, that if you're going to attack another country like Syria, Lebanon, you know, Jordan, Egypt, then you're supposed to say, well, hey, partner, in this treaty, just so you know, next week we're going to attack Lebanon, Syria, you know, whatever. And Israel doesn't want any part of that either.
Right.
So, you know, this sort of, you have to keep your sense of humor in these things. And
yeah, well, you know, the other thing is, you look at the way America operates in Africa. We tell the Ethiopians and the Ugandans and the Kenyans, hey, listen, we want you to go and murder Somalis for us. And they say, hup to, and they go and do what they're supposed to do. Because we're the empire, and they're the satellites, and that's how it works. We hire them to kill people for us. There are legions out there, you know? But then, with Israel, every time we have a war in the Middle East, we have to beg them to stay out of it. Otherwise, it'll look like the war is for Israel, which everybody already knows it is anyway, and but they can't help us, or else it'll cost any support we have in the region, even from the sock puppet governments who have, you know, some kind of public opinion they're answerable to, you know?
Well, even the divine David Petraeus has admitted in congressional testimony that the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, which is unresolved mostly because of Israeli intransigence, is a security risk to the United States. Now, he said that, and then he kind of worried about it very much and talked to the neocons, and they said, no, don't worry about it, David, we'll cover you. So Max Boot, the arch neocon pundit, wrote an article saying, David Petraeus is not anti-Semitic. He just didn't know what he was saying. Israel is not really a threat to the United States. So it reaches ridiculous proportions. But what I'm saying about a sense of humor here, there's a wag that I know who says, you know, when we offered Israel the status of the 51st state, they turned us down right off the bat. And I said, well, why would they do that? And he said, well, then they'd only have two senators. Yuck, 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 yuck.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a lightweight way of saying that if Israel passes, if Israel wants a resolution passed in the Senate saying that if Israel attacks Iran, U.S. is in automatically, then they'll ask them to do it. And guess what? They have done it. Luckily, in this sense, the Congress doesn't declare war anymore or send people off to war as the president. And he and the military know full well this would be a disaster. So you know, it's something the American people don't know. There are incredibly courageous Jews in this country. I'm a member of Jewish Voice for Peace. You can be an associate member. And there's a lot of good being done, and this thing will be turned around. But right now, it all looks very, very mousy, partly because of the wuss that we have occupying the Oval Office.
All right, now let me ask you this about Syria, and in fact about, well, you know, what Ariel Sharon and John Bolton all said in Haaretz right at the dawn of the Iraq War, that Syria and Libya better be next, and all of this, and, you know, the Joe Biden plan, Joe, I'm a Zionist Biden, was always the leading voice in the United States, the most powerful voice in the United States for breaking Iraq into three. We now have the Iraq War spreading into Syria and back again. I don't know if you've been reading Patrick Coburn in The Independent lately, but it's absolutely horrifying what's going on in Iraq and what's about to get much worse there. And, of course, Libya is torn apart. Warring militias and all that too. And, from time to time, people bring up the Yanan plan, which is, you know, like the clean break strategy only from, what, 1982, I believe, which says, hey, let's just break up all the Arab states into the smallest pieces we can. And then that way, you know, relative their power to ours, we'll simply rule the place. Now, this seems to be, obviously you can see the correlation. The question to you is about causation. Is this what, for example, the American neocons were really working for, is just smashing all of these states? And in fact, before we answer, let me also bring up, because I meant to already in the beginning of the question, there's a piece in Foreign Affairs by the former head of Mossad saying, Israel doesn't want Assad to fall. Israel is afraid of Al-Qaeda coming to power even more than they're worried about Iran's increasing influence in Syria if Assad survives. And that's why they bombed the missiles. And this is what I guessed, by the way, right off the bat. That's why they bombed the missiles, was to keep them out of the hands of the rebels, not out of the hands of Hezbollah. But so that either means that's obviously the case, that they're scared to death that the regime in Damascus will fall, or that's a damn lie because that's what they want us to think, right? I don't know. It seems to me also, I'll say one more thing in my setup to your answer would be, the great piece, I forget the author's name, but it ran in Salon.com years ago, called How Chalabi Conned the Neocons. And how, really, what he was promising them was a democratic Shiite Iraq that was going to ultimately support some kind of, you know, Hashemite leadership or something, and be very friendly to Israel and build a water and oil pipeline to Haifa rather than permanent chaos. So, you know, it seems to me like it's sort of too simple of an explanation, but then again, it does certainly fit. So now I'll shut up and let you say whatever you like saying.
Let me just say this, that I think the cardinal flaw, the big mistake, was Hillary Clinton think that, you know, saying that Assad has to go. That opened the door to all manner of people who wanted to help him go. And the only hope that I see right now is the notion that John Kerry did go to Moscow. This thing is not possibly, cannot possibly be resolved without Moscow. And finally, if the Russians do cooperate with us, I think there could be a resolution. I've got to take off now. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks very much, Ray. Sorry about my overly long question and no time to answer. But anyway, talk to you soon.
Okay.
Thanks again. All right, everybody, that's the great Ray McGovern. Oh, hell, well, we didn't get his answer about the Yanan plan, did we? But, yeah, I kind of think he's right that they're trying to take back the must-step-down thing. Obama echoed her, too, though. I don't know.
Admit it. Our public debate has been reduced to reading each other's bumper stickers. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. I made up most of them, and most of those when I was mad as hell about something. So if you hate war, empire, central banking, cops, Republicans, Democrats, gun grabbers, and status of all stripes, go to LibertyStickers.com, and there's a good chance you'll find just what you need for the back of your truck. Own a bookstore? Sell guns at the show? Get the wholesaler's deal. Buy any 100 stickers and they drop down in price to $1 a piece. You can spread the contempt and make a little money too. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Over at AIPAC, the leaders of the Israel lobby in Washington, D.C., they're constantly proclaiming unrivaled influence on Capitol Hill. And they should be proud. The NRA and AARP's efforts make them look like puppy dogs in comparison to the campaigns of intimidation regularly run by the neoconservatives and Israel firsters against their political enemies. But the Israel lobby does not remain unopposed. At the Council for the National Interest, they put America first, insisting on an end to the empire's unjustified support for Israel's aggression against its neighbors, and those whose land it occupies, and pushing back against the lobby's determined campaign in favor of U.S. attacks against Israel's enemies. CNI also does groundbreaking work on the trouble with evangelical Christian Zionism and neocon-engineered Islamophobia and drumming up support for this costly and counterproductive policy. Please help support the efforts of the Council for the National Interest to create a peaceful, pro-American foreign policy. Just go to councilforthenationalinterest.org and click donate under About Us at the top of the page. And thanks. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Every month, Plumline Individualist editor Sheldon Richman brings you important news and opinions on policy by heroic FFF President Jacob Hornberger, hard-hitting journalist columnist James Bovard, and others from the best of the libertarian movement. The Future of Freedom tackles the most important issues facing our country, from the bankrupt and insane welfare and regulatory states, to foreign wars and empire, the dismal state of our economy, and ongoing assaults on civil liberties. This society needs peace and freedom for prosperity to prevail. Subscribe to the Future of Freedom in print for just $25 a year or online for $15 a year at fff.org/subscribe. And hurry up, because this summer they'll be running my articles about the wars in Libya, Syria, and Somalia in the Future of Freedom too. That's fff.org/subscribe for the Future of Freedom. And tell them Scott sent you. Oh man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up, turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner. Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The Bill of Rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. They're for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey, guys, I got his laptop.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. First of all, thanks to the show's sponsors and donors who make it possible for me to do this. Secondly, I need more sponsors and more donors if the show is to continue. ScottHorton.org/donate has all the links to use PayPal, Give.org, Google Wallet, WePay.com, and even Bitcoins to make a donation in any amount. You can also sign up for monthly donations of small and medium-sized amounts through PayPal and Give.org. Again, that's ScottHorton.org/donate for all the links. To advertise on the site or the show, email me, Scott@ScottHorton.org. And thanks.